for these four young men. God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Now at the end of the days, when the king had said that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. Then the king interviewed them, and among them all, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they served before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in all his realm. Thus Daniel continued until the first year of King Cyrus. Now in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. Then the king gave the command to call the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king. And the king said to them, "I have had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to know the dream." Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, "O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will give the interpretation." The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, "My decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me and its interpretation, you shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made an ash heap. However, if you tell the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts, rewards, and great honor. Therefore, tell me the dream and its interpretation." They answered again and said, "Let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will give its interpretation." The king answered and said, "I know for certain that you would gain time, because you see that my decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me, there is only one decree for you, for you have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the time has changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can give me its interpretation." The Chaldeans answered the king and said, "There is not a man on earth who can tell the king's matter. Therefore, no king, lord, or ruler has ever asked such things of any magician, astrologer, or Chaldean. It is a difficult thing that the king requests, and there is no other who can tell it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh." For this reason, the king was angry and very furious, and gave the command to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree went out, and they began killing the wise men, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. Then with counsel and wisdom, Daniel answered Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, "Why is the decree from the king so urgent?" Then Arioch made the decision known to Daniel. So Daniel went in and asked the king to give him time, that he might tell the king the interpretation. Then Daniel went to his house and made the decision known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they might seek mercies from the God of heaven concerning this secret, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. So Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his, and he changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things and knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank you and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and might. You have now made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's demand." Amen.
Amen.
Now today we come to the opening paragraph of Daniel chapter 2, verses 1 to 13. And here in these verses we are taken to the throne room of world power. The center and heart of the ancient world. The place of policy, of planning, and of political control. And what is revealed to us as we're taken into this inner sanctum of power? Well, what is revealed is utter confusion. Confusion born of man's inherent condition without God. For here in this inner room we find there is ignorance, there is pride, and there is fear. And as these three things mingle together, they produce its dreadful and obnoxious smell, the smell of death. I want us to examine three parties that are involved in the throne room debate, as we might call it. The first party is God himself. Verse 1. Now in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. Now God is not mentioned explicitly in this verse, but we are told that Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. Now who sent the dreams? It was, of course, God. We're told that specifically in verse 29 by Daniel. As for you, O king, thoughts came to your mind while on your bed about what would come to pass after this. And he who reveals secrets has made known to you what will be. The dream came from God. Now, before we just look at this, it's worth noting that in verse 1, these things took place in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. And as many commentators point out, 3 years have already elapsed since Daniel and his friends are already standing before the king, as we've been told in verse 19 of chapter 1. Well, the problem is easily resolved. If you remember the accession year way of measuring a king's reign, where the first year is actually year 0, and then the second year is year 1, and the third year is year 2. And also remembering that when it speaks of the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign in the Jewish reckoning of years, we could be well into actually the fourth year. That may seem confusing to you, but I assure you it is actually correct. So sometime, perhaps towards the end of the third year or even into the fourth year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, these things take place. But the important thing is to notice that it is God who precipitates the crisis. It is God who sends the dreams. It is God who interferes and intervenes in that courtroom drama. Why does God do this? Well, his ultimate purpose is, of course, good and gracious. He wants to bring blessing to Nebuchadnezzar and to these people. And we'll see how that turns out as we read through the book. But in the short term, it isn't blessing that comes, but trouble. In the short term, these dreams expose the ignorance, the pride, and the fear of all those people in that courtroom. In the short term, God's interference brings difficulty. And we must recognize that this is often God's means of doing great good. When God first interferes in the lives of men, very often, obviously not always, God works in different ways, but very often when we see how God works, the initial result is trouble. It is crisis. And it is only as a result of a divinely ordained crisis that men and women begin to turn to the Lord. We must remember that Satan, the enemy of men, is a liar, a deceiver, and a marvelously convincing cheat. And Satan's great work is to cover over the true condition of a person's heart and soul so that the disease that lies within him goes untreated and unremedied until the day he dies, till the day when the disease finally kills him. It is rather like a septic wound which festers away underneath a beautifully prepared and finished bandage that Satan makes sure that he keeps on replacing and rebandaging so that it looks just fine, it smells just fine, but underneath the surface is this septic gangrenous wound that is killing and destroying. And very often when God intervenes in the events of men, the first thing that he does is simply to remove the bandaging. It is to remove the covering and to expose the truth. And that exposure is painful. Rip a bandage off somebody who has an open wound and the whole experience is immediately painful. And then it's hurtful and it's devastating as the person realizes the extent of the damage that has been done and is being done. And yet the removal of that cover, that false, fake cover, is the beginning of restoration and healing, isn't it? It's the beginning of the whole process that leads to a full restoration. And this dream, if you like, is God's bandage removal in the case of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was so calm. He was so confident. So sure, so much at ease, but suddenly everything changes. God intervenes. He sends the dream. He removes the bandage and the gangrenous wound is exposed. Well, that brings us on then to the second player in the drama. It is the king himself. Now, as we've seen, the dream immediately exposed the king. And the first thing that it exposed was the king's ignorance. Just compare chapter 1, verses 19 and 20 with chapter 2, verses 5 and 6. I'll read them just immediately after one another so you can see the contrast. Chapter 1, 19. The king interviewed them and none among them was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael and Azariah. Therefore they served before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in all his realm. King answered and said to the Chaldeans, "My decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me and its interpretation, you shall be cut in pieces and your houses shall be made an ash heap. However, if you tell me the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts, rewards, and great honor. Therefore, tell me the dream and its interpretation." What a change. In the first scene, we have Nebuchadnezzar sitting in his throne room. He's got these four bright young men and he's examining them from his books. It's the wise and knowledgeable king that's comfortably seated upon his throne, in control of everything, knowing everything, sure of everything. But when we come into chapter 2, it is a man enraged. It is a man who has completely lost control. It is a man exposed. And why? Because in chapter 1, the king is proud of his knowledge. But in chapter 2, the king is ashamed of his ignorance. Now, it's worth considering at this stage the extent of the king's ignorance, because there is some discrepancy over this. Some argue that the king had forgotten his dream completely, that he'd had a dream, that the dream troubled him, but when he woke up, he'd completely forgotten the dream. And they explain this in terms of the agitation. There's nothing more agitating and frustrating than to have had a dream and to have forgotten it. There is a quote in Babylonian law which says that if a man has a dream and forgets his dream, that his gods are displeased with him. But there are problems with that view. According to that view, verse 9 is a complete bluff. In verse 9, Nebuchadnezzar says, "If you do not make known the dream to me, there is only one decree for you. For you have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the time has changed. Therefore, tell me the dream and I shall know that you can give me the interpretation." What Nebuchadnezzar is there claiming is that I know what the dream is and I will know whether you're telling me the truth, because you're telling me the dream will confirm what I already know, and then I will be able to trust you for the interpretation, which I don't know. So if he has forgotten the dream, verse 9 is a bluff, that seems to be unlikely. Also, if he's forgotten the dream, I would think that his reaction would have been more humble. He really would have been sincerely concerned to get both the dream and its interpretation. He would have hunted further, perhaps, or given the men more time. As it was, according to him, these men were supposed to be able to interpret these things. Well, if they can't even tell me the dream, I can't trust their interpretation. And for that reason, others argue, on the other extreme, that Nebuchadnezzar knew the dream 100%. And that the reason why he was troubled was because he realized that this dream was not like normal dreams. It was an enormously significant dream, and yet he didn't understand its significance. Like being handed something that's incredibly important and yet not knowing why it's important. It's extremely unsettling. Also, he knew that these wise men had their dream law manuals. That's what these Chaldeans, astrologers and so on were. They were experts in the dream law of the Chaldeans. And over the centuries, they'd built up books, massive, massive libraries full of books on dream law that covered virtually every single kind of dream and story you could possibly imagine. And because they were experts, they could access some part of some book somewhere that had been written and give an interpretation. But Nebuchadnezzar perhaps now is beginning to lose faith in this view, in this way of interpreting dreams. And he wanted to be sure, and so he's 100% certain of his dream, but he's putting the Chaldeans under this test of confidence. I have a problem with that. The problem with that view is that it seems strange that Nebuchadnezzar should lose confidence in the learning that he is so confident in chapter 1. In chapter 1, he sets up his university and he's teaching all these young men the ways of the Chaldeans and the teachings of the Chaldeans to make them clever Chaldeans. And then, according to this view in chapter 2, suddenly he's lost all confidence in the learning of the Chaldeans. That doesn't seem to fit to me. So there is a third option, which I put to you. It's only an opinion. Nobody can be sure of these things. My view is that Nebuchadnezzar partially remembered the dream. Dreams are like that, aren't they? You have a dream and you remember part of it. And there is nothing more frustrating than remembering part of your dream but not all of your dream. Knowing perhaps the beginning and the bit that's two-thirds of the way in but missing the center part and the conclusion, and it driving you absolutely crazy because you can't fit it together. Now, Nebuchadnezzar had had many dreams, but never before had he had a dream from God. And he knew that this dream was different. He knew that this dream mattered. And he could remember enough of the dream to be sure of that, but he couldn't remember all of the dream. And so he was driven to distraction by having laid before him a part of something incredibly significant and not being able to piece it all together. And so he wanted these wise men to come and piece it all together for him. But they were unable to do so. Nebuchadnezzar's ignorance drove him quite literally completely mad. He realized that all the learning and all the knowledge that had been built up was inadequate. That despite all this university education and everything else, despite the fact that he was so proud of his systems and his books and his libraries, there was no answer in the time of real crisis. And so he loses it. He behaves in a completely irrational way. There is no sense to what he does and says. What he does and says is complete nonsense. What will it achieve, killing all of his wise men? It will achieve absolutely nothing. It won't give him an answer to his dream. So he goes, in these verses, quite literally completely mad. He was obviously inclined towards this sort of thing. By the time we come to chapter 4, he is driven what we would call insane completely. But here in verses 12 and 13, we have the beginnings of it, chapter 2. The king was angry, very furious, gave the command to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree went out and they began killing the wise men. Now, why should this ignorance drive Nebuchadnezzar so mad? Well, because the ignorance was chafing against his pride. Nebuchadnezzar was a man of pride. He was proud of his knowledge. He was proud of his power. He understood that knowledge is power. He understood that to know is to be in a position to control. And he knew that to be ignorant was to be in a position of weakness. And weakness for Nebuchadnezzar was something that he could not cope with. He had to be Lord. He had to be master. He had to be in complete control of everything. And so here he was, being shown that he was ignorant. And because he was ignorant, he was weak. And how he hated that. How that chafed against his pride and exposed the third element, fear. He was terrified. Here we have, if you like, the grinding stone of ignorance and the metal bar of pride. And as the two hit one another, the sparks of fear fly off in all directions. So it was with Nebuchadnezzar. Hence the decree, they're all to be killed. So in the courtroom drama, we have God, we have Nebuchadnezzar. But thirdly, of course, we have the wise men. For they too are exposed. These wise men prided themselves on their understanding and their ability to grasp what was beyond others. We are the ones in the know. We are the ones with 15 letters after our names. We are the ones with several degrees. We are the ones who have spent decades studying and learning. We are the people who know. And since knowledge is power, Nebuchadnezzar cannot survive without us. He depends on us. He's always calling upon us. He needs our wisdom. He needs our contribution. We're crucial to the security of his kingdom. But all of a sudden, they lose everything. Because God intervened. And God's dream floors them and exposes them completely. It was designed to. That was the whole purpose of it. They simply did not know what to do. They did not have any way of bluffing now. They didn't have any books they could look at for an answer now. There was no way they could even come up with a convincing deceit. They couldn't gloss this. They were completely out of their depth. They were ignorant. And ignorance was hateful to them. Their pride was wounded. Just like Nebuchadnezzar's pride was harmed by his ignorance, so was the pride of these wise men. Look at their responses. Verse 3. Their first response in verse 4. O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream and we will give the interpretation. They repeat it. Verse 7. Let the king tell his servants the dream and we will give its interpretation. But then verse 10, after the king insists, there is not a man on earth who can tell the king's matter. Therefore, no king, lord or ruler has ever asked such things of any magician, astrologer or Chaldean. It is a difficult thing that the king requests, and there is no other who can tell it to the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh. What is the argument of these Chaldean wise men? Basically, to summarize it, their argument is this. You're accusing us of being inadequate. We are not inadequate. We are entirely adequate. It's you, Nebuchadnezzar. You're breaking the rules. You're being unreasonable. You're expecting something that no man could possibly ever give you. You are asking for something that lies beyond the realm of human knowledge and understanding, and we simply don't have access to it. None of us can access the realm of the gods, verse 11. The gods do not dwell with human flesh. We have no way of gaining understanding of the mind of the gods. We can't access heaven. There's no way that we can tap in to the thinking of the gods. You're utterly unreasonable, Nebuchadnezzar. That was their argument. You see, their pride was wounded. And not only do we find ignorance and pride here among these wise men, we also find fear, and they had reason to be afraid. Nebuchadnezzar had given his decree. Already they were being rounded up. Death was on the doorstep. And of course, it is into the midst of this remarkable drama that God's man strides forth. It is a great story, isn't it? And the results of Daniel's intervention into this whole situation of utter confusion is quite remarkable, and we're going to be looking at that over the next weeks. But for today, I want us just to meditate for a few moments on this confusion. For as it was in Babylon in 600 BC, so it is today in Britain in 2000 AD, isn't it? It hasn't changed. Do we not see this confusion in every context, in every place? Are we not suffering with the same three problems? Ignorance, pride, and fear. And do they not produce the same results as we found there in that courtroom 2,600 years ago? Just think of a few contemporary issues that face us today and that men and women might gather together and discuss and try to find some answer to, rather like this courtroom drama. On an international, global scale, the greatest crisis that faces us is terrorism, isn't it? Global terrorism. And what strikes you about the world's response to global terrorism? Well, in the context of these verses, there is one thing that strikes us more than anything else. It's ignorance, isn't it? We do not know what to do. It really would be rather refreshing to have somebody stand up and say that, wouldn't it? We are confronted with a problem here that is so big, so complex, so difficult, that there is no easy answer. There is no quick political solution. We cannot just decide to do X, Y, and Z with the sure and certain confidence that that will bring the security that we need. We are ignorant. We are confronted with a problem that has so many different faces, so many different aspects, and so many different avenues that we can't find a solution. But then ignorance chafes against pride, doesn't it? Because one thing that we cannot afford to say as a society, as a world, particularly in the West, we cannot ever afford to say, we don't know. Whenever do you find any politician of any hue, any world leader of any kind, ever standing up and saying, we have no idea what to do? This problem is so far beyond us. We're just floundering. We've tried this, it's failed. We've tried that, it's failed. We've tried the other, it's failed. Everybody knows that. We're desperate. Nobody says that. Because that wounds our pride. We can't possibly say that. That means we're not in control. That means we don't know what to do. That means we haven't got an answer. And if we haven't got an answer, then anything could happen. And so we have our politicians and our world leaders standing up and saying things that everybody knows are manifestly just not supported by the facts. And it's not, in this context, it's not politicians of a particular persuasion that we're speaking of. It's everybody, isn't it? Because in our pride, whether we're left wing or right wing, or whether we're conservative or whatever we are, nobody seems to be willing to say we're ignorant. And at the bottom of it all is fear, isn't it? We are afraid. If we look at this thing, global terrorism as it's been called, and we really do face up to our ignorance, and we allow the arrow, the dagger of ignorance, to penetrate our pride, then we bleed with fear, don't we? It is terrifying. It is, isn't it? just like Nebuchadnezzar and the wise men. There's no difference. Or what about something else? The collapse of family life. Everybody recognizes that in our country today, family life is disintegrating away. At an ever-increasing rate, there are more and more and more children who are cut off from one or other of their parents or both of them. There are more and more families that are divided. There is more and more conflict. There is less and less security. And all of the statistics and all of the evidence says this is a bad thing. But what can we do about it? Well, wouldn't it be refreshing for somebody to stand up again and say, well, really, we're floundering. We don't really have an answer. We don't really know what to do. This is a slippery slope that we have jumped onto as a society, and we are going down it at such a rate, we cannot stop ourselves. But nobody is willing to say we're ignorant. And so in our pride, everybody stands up with a different answer to the problem. Some say it's not a problem at all. It's in fact a good thing. So they turn the whole thing on its head. Others stand up and say, well, we need some kind of moral rearmament. We need to restore old-fashioned values. We need to get back to Victorian ways, how it used to be, and so on. And they have some plans and schemes as to how this can be done. In our pride, we believe we have an answer. The truth is, we don't. The truth is, we're in free fall. And the truth is, we have every reason to be terrified where it will take us in 20 years' time. But who's facing up to that? Nobody. That's too much to bear. Or take an issue that's personal. The pursuit of happiness. There is one thing that everybody is concerned for, and that is to gain happiness. It is, of course, a human instinct. It is God's intention that we should be happy. So to pursue happiness is, of course, a right thing. But how? How can men pursue happiness? Haven't 2,000 years of history since the Roman Empire and however many thousands of years before that of civilization taught us that we are ignorant as human beings of how to attain this ephemeral thing called happiness? How many different civilizations and different cultures come up with a different answer only to find the sand fall through their fingers and be left with nothing but ruins? The Romans were convinced they had the answer to happiness, a perpetual answer. Just go to Rome today. It's a very, very salutary experience just to walk through the ruins. There's nothing left. It's a destroyed place. And what of us today as we pursue happiness? Is anybody standing up and saying, well, we don't actually know what we're doing here. We don't actually have an answer. We don't really know a way for. We're ignorant. Nobody dares to say that because our pride is wounded. If we say we cannot attain happiness, we cannot find happiness, we cannot take hold of real security and contentment, it's beyond us, it's above us, it's in the realm of God and we can't reach it, then that wounds our pride. We can't say that. That fills us with fear and makes us insecure. And so we come up with our answers and our solutions. And we all know what the world is saying are the solutions. Everybody has their own view as to how to pursue happiness. And millions and millions and millions of people spend their whole life doing it. But where is it all leading us? Whether it's global terrorism, the collapse of family life, the pursuit of happiness, or a thousand other issues, where is it all leading us? What are we achieving? Where are we going? Well, what we're actually doing is making ourselves literally mad like Nebuchadnezzar. We are driving ourselves to utter distraction because we know we must have an answer. We refuse to turn to God for it.
And so we race round and round and round and round, determined to find it, to find it, to find it. And yet we never do. So what happens in the end? We become bitter. Bitterness creeps into the hearts of men and women. How many people today are bitter? They are angry. Angry with the world. Angry with God. Angry with society. Angry with politicians. Angry with everybody else that's out there. Feeling let down, feeling disappointed, feeling frustrated. Men and women turn to anything to find some kind of relief from it. That is why the problem of substance abuse gets worse and worse and worse in our society. Whether it is alcohol that is consumed in vastly increasing quantities all of the time, or whether it is the taking of drugs that we know is a problem that is spiraling out of control at such an alarming rate. And nobody, of course, as we've already said, has an answer. Some say, make the drugs legal. Others say, ban them all. Some say, be more lenient. Others say, be harsher. Who has an answer? Who has an answer? Linked with all of this is a reckless abandonment to wild living, particularly amongst the young, who are the most bitter and the most angry, because they can see that there is no future really. And so we have this problem of people who are sold out to a type of music and a type of film watching and a type of lifestyle and late night activity, which just renders them nothing better than mere animals. Men and women turn to abortion to try and deal with the problem of a baby that's arriving. Men and women turn to divorce to try and deal with the problem of relationships that don't work. We sell ourselves out to unfettered selfishness, making ourselves the center of all things. Who's free from this? Who has an answer? We look at this scene in Daniel 2. And although we might try to ridicule Nebuchadnezzar and dismiss these wise men and dissociate ourselves from them and say, you know, we're not like that. Our world isn't like that. Our society is different to that. We don't go around beheading people just because they can't interpret a dream. Well, yes, we do things in a different way. But fundamentally, the same three things are there. Ignorance, pride, and fear. And they lead to the same thing, despair, and ultimately death. Is there an answer? Is there an answer to any of these things? Is there a way to freedom from ignorance and pride and fear? The wise men said wiser than they knew in verse 11. There is no other who can tell it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. Yes, the answer to these things did lie in heaven, but not with many tin pot gods or tribal deities, but with the one true living God, the one who is the Lord. Daniel knew him. Daniel turned to him. Verse 18, they sought mercies from the God of heaven. Daniel knew there was a place to go for answers. There was a place to go for wisdom. There was a place to go to know the solution, the way forward, and it was to God. And as Daniel turns to God in the midst of the crisis, God shows him the way. God reveals the answer. Verse 19, the secret was revealed to Daniel. What a tremendous statement. The secret, that which was driving Nebuchadnezzar and the wise men and the whole of Babylon to complete distraction, was revealed to Daniel. Not because Daniel had any special wisdom or understanding or ability to analyze things that was better than others, but because Daniel, quite the opposite, had abandoned confidence in himself and went to God. God himself is the truth. And therefore God himself is the answer to ignorance. God himself is the Lord of heaven and earth. And therefore God himself is the answer to our human pride as we fall before him in worship and adoration. God himself is the Lord who is in control, and therefore he is the answer to fear. God sends the crisis. God sent the dream. God sends the crises in our world. He sends them to remove the bandages that cover our septic wound. So we look at global terrorism and we say, where is God? We do not have a full answer, but we note this. God's purpose in it is to drive men to himself. You do not have an answer to this. You do not have a solution to this. You cannot solve this. And everything you try, it comes to nothing. What is the message? Turn to me. Look unto me, all the ends of the earth. Why? For in me there is wisdom. In me there is understanding. In me there is salvation. Not in any other. Not in human schemes or ideas or plans, but in God. As families collapse in our society, and therefore because the family is the bedrock of human society, as our human society in the West crumbles away, what is the solution? There is only one. It is to turn to God. It is to humble ourselves under God. It is to find ourselves in a condition where we say, Lord, revive your church. Lord, pour out your spirit. Lord, prosper your gospel. Lord, restore souls. It's the only answer. And as we look at men and women living their lives in despair, in weakness, they cannot lay hold on happiness. What is the only answer? The only answer is God. It is to turn to him and to find in him our joy and our delight. God is the God who works through crises. We must believe that. And the only place where the confusion of the world can be remedied fully and finally is in the place of supreme crisis, the greatest crisis that ever hit the earth, the crisis of Calvary. So whenever there is a crisis in our lives or in our world, the place we go to is the place of crisis, the place where the sin of the world was laid upon the Son of God, the place where hell opened up, and the place where death was defeated. The place where Satan was finally vanquished. The place where righteousness and justice on the one hand and love and mercy on the other hand met together. There is only one answer to the global terrorist threat, to the collapse of families, to the need of men for happiness, and to all the hundreds and thousands of other problems that we face. And the answer is the cross. There's no other answer. And so we must turn to him. And as Christians, we must never get into the danger and the trap of believing that the answers and the solutions to all of these things lie in schemes and plans and policies of men. They do not. They lie in God. And what we need to do in our day and age is to fall on our knees and cry out to God and to tell men and women there's only one answer. Turn to God. Turn to God in Christ. Go to the cross. It's the only place. Amen.